Your time management is not my problem, Warfield said. I made it abundantly clear from the start of day yesterday, start of day today, and at the start of your most recent questioning of potential jurors, we are going to finish jury selection today and opening statements are tomorrow. We are now approaching 3 o'clock and we still have alternates to seat, and I imagine at least one or two jurors. Your time was up. Now does either of you have a challenge? Before Berg could say a word, I spoke. I would like to confer with counsel first, I said. Could we take the afternoon break and then consider challenges? Very well, the judge said. 10 minutes. Step back. The lawyers returned to our tables while the judge informed the courtroom of the afternoon break. She sternly said that court would resume in 10 minutes sharp. I slid into my seat and huddled with Maggie. This is crazy, I said. 15 minutes to question 3 jurors? She's nuts, and this is reversible. Look, you have to calm down, Mick, Maggie said. You can't cross swords with a judge before the trial even starts. That's suicide. I know. I'll be calm. Now what are we going to do? We only have one challenge. Before answering, I looked over and saw that Berg was also huddling with her co-counsel, the bow-tie guy. I had an idea. I looked back at Maggie. How many challenges do they have left? I asked. She looked at a score sheet she was keeping. 3, she said. I don't want to give up ours, I said. I want to try something. I want you to go into the hall for the break. Don't come back until the 10 minutes are up. What? Don't worry about the challenges yet. Just go. She tentatively got up and went out through the gate toward the door to the hall. I checked the prosecution table, and then turned toward Chan, the courtroom deputy, and signaled him over. I opened my file, revealing the ice cube tray chart. I quickly switched the post-its I had used to mark jurors 21 and 17, putting the green light on the school teacher. The deputy stepped over. I gotta use the can, I said. Can somebody take me back? Stand up, he said. I did as instructed. Chan handcuffed me and walked me to the custody door. You've got about 5 minutes, he said. I only need 2, I said. He led me into the secured holding area and into a cell where there was an open toilet. There were 2 men sitting on a bench in the cell, at this hour most likely waiting to be transported back to Twin Towers after their court appearances. I stood at an angle, preventing them from seeing my business, and urinated into the toilet while Chan waited in the hallway outside the cell. I took my time washing my hands in the sink next to the toilet. I wanted to give the bowtie guy enough time to see that I had left my chart open on the defense table. Let's go, Holler, Chan said from outside the tank. Coming, I said. After I returned to my seat at the defense table, I closed the file and looked over at the prosecution table. Berg and her cohort were no longer talking, but looking straight ahead and waiting for court to resume. Soon, several members of the jury pool were returning to the courtroom. Maggie came back to the defense table and sat down. So, what are we doing? She asked. I'm going to try to get 68 kicked for cause, I said. And I'm hoping the state boots the teacher. Why would they do that? He's perfect for them. I know I'd want him if this was my case. I flipped open the file and pointed to the post-its. Maggie was staring at them, putting the ruse together, when the judge returned to the bench and called counsel forward. At the bench, the prosecution went first. Your Honor, the people will use a peremptory challenge to dismiss number 17, Berg said. I jerked my head back like I'd been slapped, and then shook it in disappointment. I hoped I wasn't overacting. You're sure? Warfield asked. Yes, Your Honor, Berg said. The judge wrote a note down on a pad. Mr. Holler, anything from the defense? She asked. Yes, Your Honor, I said. The defense seeks the dismissal of juror 68 for cause. That cause being what? The judge asked. clear animosity exhibited toward the defense? I said. Because she doesn't like to be called ma'am? Warfield asked. I don't want to be called that either. That and a generally combative tone, Judge, I said. She clearly doesn't like me, and that is grounds for cause. Your Honor, can I be heard on this? Berg said. You don't need to be, Warfield said. I'm denying the motion to dismiss for cause. My tally shows you have one last peremptory, Mr. Holler. You want to use it? I paused for a moment to consider. If I used my last peremptory, I would have nothing left, while we sat the replacements for 68 and 17. I didn't want the trumper on the jury, but it was risky being unable to control the last two slots on the panel. The alternates would be handled separately, with additional peremptory challenges. Mr. Holler, the judge said, I am waiting. I pulled the trigger. Yes, Your Honor, I said. We thank and excuse Juror 68. And that is using your last challenge, Warfield asked. Yes, Your Honor. Very well, you can step back. I knew it would be useless to ask for additional challenges. Berg would oppose it, and the judge, with her hard-line adherence to her schedule, would be disinclined to be generous. I returned to my place at the defense table and decided to dwell on the one good thing that had just happened. I had managed to get rid of two potentially problematic jurors with one challenge. I would never know whether leaving my chart open to the potential spying eyes of the prosecution table had played a part in the dismissal of the schoolteacher, but I had to think it did. I listened as the judge thanked and dismissed him, along with the widow of the war hero. For the moment, the chef from the Hollywood Bowl was secure. The judge quickly referred to a list of numbers randomly selected by a computer and called the next two prospective jurors into the box. We had little more than an hour to finish. Chapter 39. Thursday, February 20th. It was time. It was Thursday morning at 10 a.m., and the trial would now move past the preliminaries to opening statements from the lawyers. The jury and alternates had been seated the day before without additional angst from me. My gamble with my last peremptory had paid off in that the final candidates for placement on the jury had not raised any serious flags for the defense. The jury was sworn in, and we were good to go. I felt comfortable with the overall panel. There were no known prosecution bogeys, and three members of the jury I actually thought tilted toward the defense side of the scale. In most trials, you're lucky if you get even one. Still, my comfort with the jury was offset by the knot in my stomach. I was fully recovered from the attack on the bus, but the tension of a sleepless night had carried through into the day. I was nervous. I had tried many cases, and I knew that anything could happen. It wasn't a comforting knowledge. I was fully prepared to engage in this battle, but I knew there would be casualties, and I could not guarantee that the truth would not be among them. Innocent men were found guilty. I didn't want to be one of them. An opening statement is merely a blueprint of the case to come. My strategy was a third-party culpability defense. That was a legal way of saying somebody else did it, and I was either intentionally framed or the police were so incompetent that they bungled the case and framed me in the process. I was fully aware that it would be awkward and possibly off-putting for me to stand in front of the jury and espouse this line of defense. This was why I had assigned the opening statement to Maggie McPherson. I wanted her to point to me and summon all her fierceness when she said I was innocent and that the state did not have a case that would prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. At the same time, I didn't want Maggie saying much beyond that. When it came to opening statements, I was from the Legal Siegel School of Law. He always said, save your powder, meaning less is more. Don't reveal your case or its surprises until it's time to present your evidence. That's when it mattered. Legal Siegel also said that opening statements were not worth spending much time on, because they would soon be forgotten as the prosecution presented its case, followed by the defense. There was the option of withholding the defense's opening statement until the start of its case. I had taken that option on occasion in prior trials, but I never liked doing it. I always felt it unwise to miss the opportunity to address the jury early on, no matter how briefly. Since we were starting this trial on a Thursday, I knew it would be 6 or 7 days before the defense phase started, and that seemed too long to go without countering the state with my own view of the case. I passed all this wisdom on to Maggie, though such advice was not remotely necessary to her. She had given and sat through more than her share of opening statements, and already knew that less was always more. However, this wisdom was apparently never part of Dana Berg's training. She stood before the jury first and delivered an opener that lasted almost 90 minutes. I would have preferred to sleep through it, but I had to carefully monitor it and take notes. An opening statement was a promise to the jury of what you will present during your case in chief. It was unwise to promise something and then not deliver it. That was why I took notes. I would keep a scorecard, and as the case progressed, I would be sure to point out to the jury where the state had failed to deliver on the goods promised. Berg started by detailing the night of my arrest and the discovery of Sam Scales in the trunk of my car. This was where she made her first mistake, telling the jury that they would hear from Officer Roy Milton about how a routine traffic stop started when he saw my car had no license plate, led to the discovery of the murder victim. I wrote her words down verbatim because I would use them against Officer Milton when he was brought into court to testify. There was nothing routine about the traffic stop or anything else that night. At an early point in her statement, Berg interjected a note about Sam Scales, describing him as a small-time grifter who never lived a life on the straight and narrow. In fact, Mr. Scales knew Mr. Holler because Mr. Holler was the attorney who defended him most often, Berg said. But no matter what crimes Mr. Scales contemplated or committed, he did not deserve to be murdered in the trunk of his lawyer's car. You must remember that no matter what you hear about Sam Scales, he was the victim in this case. While Berg went long, she was also pretty straightforward, sticking closely to what she said the evidence in the case would show. There was a lot, but it was all window dressing on the key elements of the case, that the victim was found in my trunk and that ballistic evidence would show that the killing took place in my garage. There were a few times when I could have objected when Berg strayed from statement into argument, but I was mindful of perceptions. I didn't want the jury to see me as some sort of petty referee or interrupter, so I let the editorializing go. The prosecutor wrapped it up after 85 minutes with a summary of her summary, repeating the major points she promised to deliver during the trial and sounding a lot like a closing argument. Ladies and gentlemen, the evidence we will present over the next several days will show that Mr. Holler was engaged in a long-running dispute with Sam Scales over money. It will show that he knew that his best and only chance of getting his money was to kill Sam Scales and draw it from his estate. And it will show beyond a reasonable doubt that he did indeed carry out that plan to kill Mr. Scales in the garage of his home. It would have been the perfect murder if not for the sharp eyes of a police officer who noticed a missing license plate on a dark street. I ask that you pay attention to the evidence presented and not be swayed by efforts to distract you from your very important job. Thank you. The judge called for a 15-minute break before the defense got its turn. I, of course, was going nowhere. I turned to scan the gallery as people got up to use the restrooms or just stretch their legs. I saw that the courtroom had gotten crowded as the case got underway. More media and more observers from both in and out of the courthouse. I saw several attorneys I knew and other courthouse workers. In the front row were my team and family. Sisko and Lorna. Bosch was there, and had even brought his daughter, Maddie. She sat next to my daughter. I smiled at them now. Kendall Roberts was not in the courtroom. After I was taken into custody, she had assessed her situation and decided to call it quits with me a second time. She had moved out of my house and left no forwarding address. I could not say I was left heartbroken. The strain the case had put on our relationship had been clear even before I was jailed for the second time. In fact, I couldn't blame her for extricating herself from it all. She had tried to tell me in person, coming to court for one of my hearings, but the circumstances didn't allow it. So she had written me a note and sent it to the jail. And that was the last I had heard from her. Toward the end of the break, Haley got up and squeezed down the row until she came to the railing behind the defense table and in front of Sisko. Since I was in custody, I was not allowed to touch her or get close. But Maggie slid her chair all the way back to the rail. "Thanks for being here, Hay," I said. "Of course," she said. "I wouldn't miss it for the world. You're going to win, Dad. And Mom. You're going to prove what I already know."
"Thanks, baby," I said.
"How's Maddie?"
"She's good," Haley said. "I'm glad she made it. It's really good to see Uncle Harry, too."
"How long can you stay?" Maggie asked.
"I cleared the whole day," Haley said.
"I'm not going anywhere. I mean, my mom and dad on the same team? What could be better than that?"
"I hope it doesn't leave you behind in classes," Maggie said.
"Don't worry about my classes," our daughter, the future lawyer, said. "Just worry about this."
She gestured to the front of the courtroom, meaning the case.
"We're locked and loaded," I said, confident.
"That's good," Haley said.
"Do me a favor and keep your eye on the jury," I said. "If you see anything, let me know during the breaks."
"Like what?" Haley asked.
"Like anything," I said. "A smile, a shake of the head, somebody falling asleep. I'll be watching too. But we can use any read we can get."
"You got it," she said.
"Thanks for being here," I said somberly. "I love you."
"I love you too," she said.
"Both of you." She moved back to her seat, and Sisko and Bosch leaned forward to the railing to speak confidentially, even though I had to keep the same separation from them.
"We all set on everything?" I asked.
"We're good," Sisko said.
Then he looked at Bosch for agreement, and Bosch nodded.
"Good," Maggie said.
"Looking at Dana's witness list, I'm guessing that the state's case will go to at least Tuesday. So we should be ready with subpoenas and everything else on Monday, just in case."
"Done," Sisko said.
"Good,"
Maggie said. People were returning to their seats. The break was almost over.
"Well, this is it," I said. "We're here. I want to thank you guys for everything."
They both nodded.
"This is what we do," Sisko said.
I turned back to the table and then leaned toward Maggie, who was already back to studying notes scribbled on a legal pad in front of her.
"You ready?" I asked.
"Of course," she said. "Quick and dirty."
The courtroom settled, and the judge came back to the bench.
"Mr. Holler," she said, "your opening statement."
I nodded, but it was Maggie who stood up and went to the lectern. She carried her legal pad and a glass of water. We had not informed the judge or prosecution who would be making the opening statement for the defense. I picked up a note of surprise on Berg's face when she turned in her seat toward the lectern, expecting to see me. I hoped it would be the first of many times she would be caught off guard.
"Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, good morning," Maggie said. "My name is Maggie McPherson, and I am co-counsel for the defense on this case. As you have been told by the court, the defendant, Michael Holler, is also representing himself in this trial. More often than not, it will be Mr. Holler, who stands here to question witnesses and speak to the judge. But for this opening statement, we agreed that it would be best for me to speak on his behalf."
I had a clear view of the entire jury box, and my eyes traveled from one face to another, first the front row, and then the back. I saw real interest and attention, but I knew this was the group's first exposure to the defense's case. I also knew that they might be disappointed by not getting the finer details in Maggie's speech. "I am going to be brief here," she said. "But first, let me say congratulations. You are all part of something that is sacred and one of the cornerstones of our democracy. In fact, no institution in modern society is more democratic than a jury. Look at yourselves. You are 12 strangers, randomly brought together for one purpose. You will elect a leader, and each one of you will have an equal vote. Your duty is so important because you have the power to take away a citizen's life, liberty, and livelihood. It's an awesome and urgent responsibility, and once you carry out your charge, you disband and go back to your lives. There is nothing as important as the duty you have agreed to take on in this courtroom." When we were married, I had watched Maggie in trial dozens of times, and she always riffed in opening statements on the democracy of the jury. There was no change here, except that now she stood, for the first time, for the defense. After the preamble, she got down to the case at hand. "So, now your work begins," she said. "Remember as you go, opening statements are basically all talk, not evidence. Miss Berg spoke to you for 90 minutes, but she did not give you any evidence. It was just talk. The defense wants to get to the evidence, or in the state's case, the lack of evidence. We want to prove to you that the state has made a terrible mistake and charged the wrong man, an innocent man, with this crime." Maggie raised her hand and pointed to me at the defense table. "That man is innocent," Maggie McPherson said, "and there is really nothing else to say. We don't have to prove his innocence in order for you to return a verdict of not guilty. But I promise you we will." She paused to underline the emphatic statement and looked down at the notes on her legal pad. "You are going to hear two stories in this trial," she continued. "The prosecution's story and our story. The prosecution will point the finger at the defendant. We will show that a man whose name the state will never mention and doesn't want you to even know is responsible for the death of Sam Scales. Only one of these stories can be true. We ask for your patience and diligence and hope that you will keep an open mind and wait for the defense's case. Again, only one story can be true, and you will choose it. Pay careful attention to the facts. But be aware that facts can be twisted. We will show that as we go. You all were given notebooks. Keep tabs on who is twisting the facts and who is not. Write it down so that when you go into the deliberations at the end of this trial, you know the facts and you know who told the truth and who didn't." Maggie paused to take a drink from her glass of water. It was a trial attorney's trick. Always take a prop like a glass of water to the lectern when giving an opening statement or closing argument. Taking a drink of water allows one to underline an important statement or to collect thoughts before proceeding. After putting the glass down, she moved toward her closing. "A trial is a search for truth," she said. "And in this trial, you are the truth seekers. You must be unbiased and undaunted. You must question everything. Question everything every witness says from the stand. Question their words. Question their motives. Question the prosecutor. Question the defense. Question the evidence. If you do that, you will find the truth. And that is that the wrong man sits now at the defense table while there is a killer out there still. Thank you." She took her glass and her pad and returned to the defense table. I turned to her as she sat down and I nodded. "Great start," I whispered. "Thank you," she whispered back. "Better than I could ever do." She squinted like she wasn't sure what she had just heard was true.
but I meant it. It was true.
Chapter 40. The prosecution is always tasked with establishing the timeline, presenting the evidence with a clear starting and ending point. It is linear storytelling, and is sometimes long and laborious, but required. In order to get to the body found in the trunk of my Lincoln, Dana Berg had to tell the jury how it came to be that my car was stopped and the trunk opened. That meant she had to start with Officer Roy Milton. Milton was called to the witness stand directly after the lunch break, and Berg quickly set up through testimony where he was and what he was doing when he noticed my car had no rear plate and pulled me over. She then used Milton to introduce the videos from his car and body cam, and the jury had a visceral "you are there" experience in the finding of Sam Scales in the trunk of my Lincoln. I carefully watched the jurors during the playing of the body cam. Some were clearly repulsed when the Lincoln's trunk came open and the body was revealed. Some leaned into it, fascinated, it seemed, by the discovery of the murder. As the testimony proceeded, Maggie tracked what Milton was saying against a transcript of his testimony from the discovery hearing back in December. Any contradiction could be brought up and called out during cross-examination. But Milton stuck close to the previous story, in some cases using the same wording, a sign that prior to trial, he had been coached by Berg not to stray from what was already on the record. Milton's sole purpose as a witness was to get the videos into evidence and in front of the jury. They were a powerful start to the case for the state. But then, it was my turn to take on Milton in cross-examination. I had waited 2 months for this, and my measured and polite questioning during the hearing in December would be a thing of the past. I adjusted the microphone on the lectern and went right at him with the first question. My goal was to rattle him in any way I could for as long as I could. I knew that if I succeeded, I would be rattling Dana Berg as well. "Officer Milton, good afternoon," I began. "Can you please tell the jury who it was that told you to follow and then conduct a traffic stop of the Lincoln Town car I was driving on the night of October 28th?
No, I can't," Milton said, "because that didn't happen."
"You are telling this jury that you received no prior notice or instruction to pull me over on a traffic stop after I left the Redwood Bar?"
"That is correct. I saw your car and noticed it had no plate, and
yes, we heard what you told Miss Berg. But what you are telling me and this jury now is that you received no direction to pull me over, is that correct?"
"Correct."
"Did you receive a radio call telling you to stop me?"
"No, I did not."
"Did you receive a message on your car's computer terminal?"
"No, I did not."
"Did you receive a call or a text message on your personal cell phone?"
"No, I did not."
Berg stood and objected, saying that I was repeatedly asking the same question.
"The question has been asked and answered, Your Honor," she said.
Warfield agreed.
"It's time to move on, Mr. Holler," she said.
"Yes, Your Honor," I said. "So, Officer Milton, if I were to produce a witness at this trial who alerted you to the fact that I was leaving the bar, then that person would be lying, correct?"
"Yes, that would be a lie."
I looked up at the judge and asked if the attorneys could approach the bench. She waved us up. I got there first and waited for Berg and McPherson to join. "Judge," I said, "I'd like to set up my own playback of the videos from the patrol car and Officer Milton's body cam." Berg raised her hands palms up in a "what gives" gesture.
"We just watched the videos," she said. "Are we trying to bore the jury to death?"
"Mr. Holler, explain," Warfield said. "My tech guy has put them side by side on one screen and time-coordinated them," I said. "The jury will see them simultaneously and be able to see what happens inside the car at the same moment as things are happening on the street."
"Your Honor, the people object," Berg said. We have no way of knowing whether these have been edited or altered by this so-called tech guy. You can't allow this.
Judge, we don't know if the prosecution edited or altered what they played for the jury, I said.
I will provide a copy to the prosecution and they can examine it all they want. If they find that it was altered, I'll turn in my bar ticket.
But what's really happening here is that the prosecution knows just where I'm going with this, knows that it is indeed probative, and she simply doesn't want the jury to see it. This is a search for truth, Judge, and the defense has the right to put this before the jury.
I have no idea what he's talking about, Judge, Berg said. The people still object based on lack of foundation. If he wants to play it during the defense phase, he can bring in his tech guy and try to establish foundation. But this is the state's case right now, and he should not be allowed to hijack it.
Your Honor, Maggie said, the prosecution has already laid the foundation by playing the videos to the jury. To allow the prosecution to play what it wants to show to the jury but prevent the defense from doing so would be a wholly unacceptable injury to the defense.
There was a pause, while the judge considered the intensity of Maggie's unexpected argument. It gave me pause as well.
We're going to take the afternoon break early, and I'll come back with my ruling, Warfield said. Get your equipment set up, Mr. Holler, in case I allow it. Now step back.
I returned to the defense table, pleased with our arguments, especially the strong hint from Maggie that preventing the defense from playing its video might be a reversible error. The judge adjourned court for a 15-minute break. Maggie and I never left the defense table. I stayed because my only choice would be to go back into the courtside lockup. She did because she was connecting her laptop to the courtroom's audiovisual system. If we got the judge's okay, we would put the simultaneous videos on the big screen mounted on the wall over the clerk's station and across from the jury box. While Maggie worked, I checked the courtroom and saw Haley and Maddie Bosch holding fast, still in the same seats. I nodded and smiled, and they did the same. When the judge retook the bench, she immediately ruled that I could play the simultaneous videos. While Dana Berg offered another objection, I turned to Maggie.
Wheel set? I asked.
Good to go, she said.
Okay, and where are the time codes?
Hold on. She opened her briefcase and looked through a stack of documents before pulling out a page that had the video time codes I needed in order to cross-examine Milton. I stood up and went to the lectern with the document and a remote control for the playback. The judge overruled Berg's objection, and I began. I explained to Milton that I would show him videos from both his car and his body cam, running side by side in synchronized time. I began the playback at a point before Milton followed me and while I was still in the redwood. The view from the patrol car's camera was through the windshield, looking west down 2nd Street to the intersection of Broadway and two blocks beyond to the tunnel. On the south side of 2nd Street, the red neon sign that said Redwood was visible half a block up. The view from Milton's body cam was low because he was apparently sitting slumped in his car. The screen showed his car's steering wheel and dashboard. His left arm and hand were visible, the arm propped on the sill of the open driver's side window, and his hand draped over the top of the steering wheel. I asked Milton to describe for the jury what he was seeing on the screen, and he grudgingly obliged.
Not much, if you ask me, he said. On the left is the car cam, and that is looking west down 2nd Street. Then on the right is my body cam, and I'm just sitting in the car.
The body cam was picking up the intermittent sound of the police radio in the patrol car. I let it play and checked my list of time codes. I then looked back up at the screen. Now, do you see the entrance of the Redwood up on the left side of 2nd Street? I asked.
Yes, I see it, Milton said.
The door to the bar opened, and out stepped two figures. It was too dark to identify them in the red glow of the neon. They spoke on the sidewalk for a few seconds and then one walked west in the direction of the tunnel, and the other went east, moving toward the camera. This was followed by a low-level buzzing sound that clearly came from a cell phone. I used the remote to stop the playback. "Officer Milton, was that you getting an email or a text on your cell phone?" I asked.
"Sounded like it," Milton said, matter-of-factly.
"Do you recall what the message was?"
"No, I don't. In the course of a night, I could get 50 messages. I don't remember them all the next day, let alone 3 months later."
I pushed the play button, and the videos continued. Soon the figure walking east on 2nd Street stepped into the illumination from a streetlight. It was clearly me. As I became recognizable in the light, the angle on the body cam changed, as Milton apparently straightened up in his seat. "Officer Milton, you seem to have gone on alert here," I said. "Can you tell the jury what you're doing?"
"Not really doing anything," Milton said. "I saw somebody on the street and was eyeballing him. It turned out to be you. You can read into that whatever you want, but it didn't mean anything to me."
"Your car is running at this point, correct?"
"Yes, that's standard."
"Was that message on your phone an alert that I was leaving the Redwood?"
Milton scoffed.
"No, it wasn't," he said. "I had no idea who you were, what you were doing, or where you were going." "Really?" I said. "Then maybe you can explain this next sequence." I hit the play button, and we watched. I checked the jury and saw all eyes on the screen. One witness into the trial, and I had them riding with me. I could feel it. On the screen, I had turned the corner and then disappeared off camera as I headed to the parking lot to get into my Lincoln. Seconds ticked by, with nothing happening, but I didn't want to fast forward. I wanted the jurors to know exactly what was going on here. Then, the Lincoln appeared in the patrol car cam as I drove into the left-turn lane on Broadway at 2nd. The car held there as I waited for the traffic signal to change. On the body cam video, Milton's right arm came up and pulled the transmission lever from park to drive. The move registered on the digital dashboard as a D appeared on the screen. I froze it there and looked at Milton. He still didn't look concerned. "Officer Milton," I said, "on direct examination, you told the jury that you did not decide to pursue my car until you saw that it was missing the rear plate. Can you see the rear bumper from this angle?" Milton looked up at the big screen and acted like he was bored.
"No, you can't.
But it is clear, from your own body cam, that you just put your patrol car into drive. Why did you do that if you had not seen the rear bumper of my car?" Milton was silent for a long moment as he contemplated an answer.
I guess it was just cop instincts," he finally said, "so that I would be ready to move if I needed to move."
"Officer Milton," I said, "do you want to change any of your earlier testimony to better reflect the facts as they are seen and heard on the video?" Berg sprang up from her spot to object to my badgering the witness. The judge overruled her, saying, "I want to hear his answer for myself." Milton declined the opportunity to change his testimony. "So then," I said, "it is your sworn testimony that you were not there specifically to wait and target me. Do I have that correct?"
"That's right," Milton said. Now there was a defiant tone in his voice. That was what I wanted the jury to hear. The how-dare-you-question-me tone of the police state that at least some of them knew so well. A tone that I believed would trigger their suspicions that something here was not right.
"And you do not wish to change or correct your earlier testimony?" I asked.
"No," Milton said emphatically. "I do not."
I paused for a moment to underline that answer and snuck a glance at the jury before looking down at my notes. I was sure Berg and Milton thought I was bluffing, that I was engaging in theatrics and implying that I had a witness in the wings who would further blow Milton and his story out of the water. But I didn't care about them. I was more concerned with what the jury thought. By implying as much, I had created an unspoken bargain with the jury, a promise. I would have to deliver on it or be held accountable. "Let's jump forward," I said. I advanced the video to the point where Milton popped the trunk and discovered the body. I knew it was a risky move to show the body to the jury again. Any murder victim shown in repose after a violent end will draw sympathy from a juror and may kickstart instinctive needs for justice and revenge, all of which could be directed at me, the accused. But I thought the risk-reward balance would be in my favor here. During her playback of the videos, Berg had kept the sound on a low setting. I did not. I set the audio at a level that could be clearly heard. When the trunk came up and the body was seen, there was Milton's very clear, "Oh, shit," followed by a stifled laugh that carried the unmistakable tone of gloating in it. I stopped the playback. "Officer Milton, why did you laugh when you found the body?" I asked.
"I didn't laugh," Milton said.
"What was that then? A guffaw?"
"I was surprised by what was in the trunk. It was an expression of surprise."
I knew he had prepped for this with Berg.
"An expression of surprise," I said.
"Are you sure you weren't gloating about the predicament you knew I would now be in?"
"No, that wasn't the case at all," Milton insisted. "I felt like a semi-boring night just got interesting. After 22 years, I was going to make my first arrest for homicide."
"Move to strike as non-responsive," I said to the judge.
"You asked the question, he answered," she responded. "Overruled. Continue, Mr. Holler."
"Let's listen again," I said. I replayed the moment on the video, turning the sound up louder. The gloating laugh was unmistakable, no matter how Milton tried to couch it. "Officer Milton, are you telling the jury that you did not laugh when you opened the trunk and discovered the body?" I asked.
"I'm saying I might have been a little giddy, but not gloating," Milton said. "It was a nervous laugh, that's all."
"Did you know who I was?"
"Yes, I had your ID. You told me you were a lawyer."
"But did you know of me before you pulled me over?"
"No, I did not. I don't pay much attention to lawyers and all of that."
I felt that I had gotten all I could out of the moment. I had thrown at least some suspicion on the prosecution's very first witness. I decided to leave it at that. No matter what came next, I felt we had opened the trial with a strong showing of contesting the state's evidence. "No further questions," I said. "But I reserve the right to recall Officer Milton to the witness stand during the defense phase of the trial." I returned to the defense table. Berg took the lectern and tried to mitigate the damage on redirect, but there wasn't much that could be done with the video evidence I had presented. She walked Milton through his story again, but he could not express a good and believable reason for his dropping the car into drive before he could have seen the rear bumper of my car. And the buzzing of the cell phone just prior to that had cemented in place the possibility that he had been told to pull me over. I leaned into Maggie to whisper. "Do we have the subpoena ready on his cell?" I asked. "All set," she said. "I'll take it to the judge as soon as we adjourn." We were going to ask the judge to allow us to subpoena the call and text records from Milton's personal cell phone. We had planned to follow his testimony and the playing of videos with a subpoena so as not to show our hand to Milton or Berg. My guess was that if we got the cell records, there would be no call or text that matched up with the buzzing sound heard on the video we had just played for the jury. This was because I was pretty sure that Milton would have used a throwaway phone for work like this. Either way, it would be a win when I brought him back to testify during the defense phase. If there was no record of a text to his registered cell, he would have to explain to the jury where the buzzing sound came from. And when I asked if he had a burner with him that night, his denial would ring false to the jury, who had clearly heard that unexplained buzzing sound. Overall, I felt the Milton cross-examination had been a score for the defense, and Berg apparently already needed to regroup. With a half hour still to go in the court day, she asked Warfield to adjourn early so she could review evidence with her next witness, Detective Kent Drucker. She had anticipated that the defense's opening statement and cross-examination of Milton would both last longer than they had. Warfield reluctantly agreed, but warned both sides that they should expect full days of court and should plan accordingly with their witnesses. Immediately after adjournment, Maggie went to the clerk with a subpoena for Milton's cell records. I waved goodbye to the rest of my team and my loved ones and was taken into the courtside holding tank. I changed from my suit into blues in preparation for being driven back to Twin Towers in a sheriff's patrol car. While I waited in the cell to be escorted down the security elevator to the prisoner loading garage, Dana Berg came into the holding area and looked at me through the bars. "Way to go, Holler," she said. "Score one for the defense." "The first of many," I said. "We'll see about that." "What do you want, Dana? You come to tell me you see the light and are dropping the charges?" "You wish. I just wanted to come back and say, well played, that's all." "Yeah, well, it wasn't a play. It might be a game to you, but it's life or death to me." "Then that's why you should savor today's win. There won't be any more." Having delivered her message, she turned from the bars and disappeared, heading back to the courtroom. "Hey, Dana," I called. I waited, and a few seconds later, she was back at the bars.
"What?"
"The Hollywood Bowl chef."
"What about her?"
"I wanted her on the jury. I switched the tags on my chart during the break, because I knew you'd send your bow tie guy over to steal a look." I could see the surprise momentarily move across her face. Then it was gone. I nodded. "That was a play," I said. "But today, that was the real thing." Chapter 41. Friday, February 21st. Possibly it was in reaction to the Milton testimony the day before, but Dana Berg came to court Friday morning with a plan not just to even the score in the jury's ledger, but to tip the scales permanently to the state's side. She had choreographed a day that would stack the blocks of evidence and motive against me so high that the jurors would be able to see nothing else and would go into the weekend with my guilt permeating their brains. It was a good strategy, and I needed to do something about it. Kent Drucker was the lead detective on the case. That made him lead storyteller as well. Berg used him to take the jury through the investigation at a leisurely pace. I could and did object on occasion, but it all amounted to a buzzing of gnats. I could not disrupt the flow of one-sided, unchallenged information to the jury until I could cross-examine the witness. And it was Berg's goal to prevent that from happening until after the weekend. The morning session was largely just nuts and bolts. She walked Drucker through the initial phase of the investigation, from his call-out at his home out in Diamond Bar to the full crime scene investigation. She did the smart thing and owned all the mistakes that had been made, revealing through Drucker that the victim's wallet had somehow gone missing from either the crime scene or coroner's office. "And did you ever recover the wallet?" Berg asked.
"Not yet," Drucker said. "It's just gone."
"Was there an investigation into the theft?"
"There's an ongoing investigation."
"And did losing the wallet hamper the homicide investigation?"
"To some extent, yes."
"How so?"
"Well, we were able to identify the victim pretty quickly from fingerprints, so that was not an issue. But the victim's criminal history indicated that he changed IDs frequently and adopted a new name, address, bank account, etc., with each new scam that he perpetrated. My thinking was that the wallet contained the documentation of whatever identity he was using at the time of the murder. That was gone, and it would have been useful to have that from the start.
Did you eventually find that identity?
We did, yes.
How?
We learned it through discovery in this case. The defense team had that information, and we eventually figured it out when they put the name of the victim's landlord on their witness list.
The defense team? Why would they have it ahead of the police?
I objected, telling the judge that the question asked for speculation. But the judge wanted to hear the answer and overruled. It emboldened Drucker, with long experience testifying in murder trials, to go a step too far.
I'm not clear on how the defense got ahead of us, he said. The defendant exercised his rights and stopped talking to us after his arrest.
Objection! I bellowed. The witness has just disparaged my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and not be compelled to testify against myself.
Approach the bench, the judge said angrily, glaring at Berg as she walked to the sidebar.
Maggie joined me at the bench. I could tell she was as angry as I was at Drucker's cheap shot.
Mr. Holler, you have made your objection, Warfield said. Are you requesting a mistrial?
Berg interrupted to say, Your Honor, I hardly think that—
Be quiet, Miss Berg, Warfield snapped.
You've been a prosecutor for long enough to know that you must instruct your witnesses never to comment on a defendant's right to remain silent after arrest.
I consider this a prosecutorial misconduct, and will take it under advisement to be dealt with at a later time. For now, I would like to hear from Mr. Holler.
I'd like an instruction, I said, in the strongest terms possible.
I'm capable of fashioning a suitable instruction, Mr. Holler, Warfield said, but I want to make certain that you are waiving any request for further remedy.
I am not moving for a mistrial, Your Honor, I said. I'm on trial for a crime I didn't commit. I'm here for exoneration, not just acquittal.
Even if the court were to grant motions for mistrial and to dismiss with prejudice based on prosecutorial misconduct, there would forever be a cloud of suspicion over me. I want my trial, and I will be satisfied with a strongly worded jury instruction.
Very well, Warfield said. Your motion is granted, and I will instruct the jury. You can all step back now.
Once we were all seated, the judge turned to face the jury.
Members of the jury, Detective Drucker just now unfairly commented on Mr. Holler's constitutional right to remain silent, she said. A bell once rung cannot be unheard, but I instruct you to disregard the comment and not to infer from it any evidence of guilt. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution grants to any person accused of a crime the right to remain silent and not be compelled to incriminate himself. This right is as old as this country. There are good reasons for it that are too numerous to review with you now. Suffice it to say that in this case, as you have heard, Mr. Holler is a criminal defense lawyer, and he has a firm grasp on why an accused would not want to submit to an interrogation by his accusers. He was well within his rights to decline to speak following his arrest. Detective Drucker, on the other hand, ought to know better than to even mention the assertion of a constitutional right to remain silent. So, because it is so fundamental and important to our justice system, I repeat, disregard the comment on Mr. Holler's post-arrest invocation of his right to remain silent, and do not infer from it any evidence of guilt.
The judge then turned slightly to focus on Drucker. His face was already red from humiliation.
Now, Detective Drucker, she said, do you need time to review with Miss Berg how to testify without unconstitutional, unfair, and unprofessional comment?
No, Judge, Drucker mumbled, staring straight ahead.
Look at me when I address you, Warfield said.
Drucker turned his whole body in the witness stand to look up at her.
The judge's penetrating glare held his for what he must have considered an eternity. Then she turned the lasers on Berg.
"You may resume your inquiry, Miss Berg," she said.
Resuming her position at the lectern, Berg asked, "Detective, do you know whether the defendant knew Sam Scales?"
"Over a period of years, Michael Haller appeared as counsel of record in almost every criminal case brought against Sam Scales. He had a long-term relationship with the victim and most likely knew his routines and practices."
"Objection!" I said indignantly. "Again, Your Honor, speculation!"
The judge pinned the witness with her scowl.
"Detective Drucker," she said, "you will confine your testimony to what you know from personal observation and experience. Do I make myself clear?"
"Yes, Judge," the twice-chastened detective said.
"Continue, Miss Berg," Warfield said.
Berg was trying to turn an investigative failure on the part of the police into suspicion of the defense and the defendant. I knew I might be hanging a lantern on the suspicion the prosecution was throwing at me, but a few stern warnings from the judge to the prosecution were an unexpected victory, and they blended well with my strategy of exposing the investigation and prosecution as sloppy and unfair. It was good to get these little victories in the midst of a long stretch of pro-prosecution testimony. You take them where you can get them. I soon returned to writing notes on my legal pad to remind myself to hit these strategy buttons harder during cross-examination, whatever that would finally be. Berg continued to question Drucker right up until the lunch break, and by then had only covered the first night's investigation. There was more to come in the afternoon session, and it was becoming increasingly clear that I would not get my shots at the detective until after the weekend. I checked the jury as they were filing out of the box to leave for lunch. I saw a lot of stretching of arms and signs of lethargy. The chef even yawned. It was okay for them to grow tired of the prosecution's case, just as long as they hadn't already made a decision about me. I took lunch in the courtside holding tank with Maggie and Cisco. The judge had allowed them to bring food in to me during the lunch break working sessions. Friday's meal came from Little Jewel, and I devoured the shrimp po' boy like a man who has just been rescued from a life raft, found floating in the middle of the Pacific. We talked about the case, though I had my mouth full most of the time. "We need to knock this train off its tracks," I said. "She's going to run the clock out in the afternoon session, and then those jurors go home for the weekend with my guilt in their heads."
"It's a filibuster," Maggie said. "That's what we call it in the DA's office. Keep the witness away from the defense for as long as possible."
I knew that in the afternoon session, Berg would probably move on to the part of the investigation that supported the charges against me. She would also start hitting on motive, and by the end of the day, her case would be practically complete. It would then be more than 48 hours before I got the chance to fight back in cross-examination. Realistically, the afternoon session would last 3 hours. The lunch recess ended at 1:30, and no judge in the building would keep a jury past 4:30 on a Friday afternoon. I needed to cut a big chunk out of that 3 hours and somehow knock Berg's case delivery into next week. It wouldn't matter how much time she monopolized on Monday. I'd step up with cross-examination the minute it was over. It was the weekend I couldn't give her. 2 full days, with only one side of the story in a juror's mind, was an eternity. I looked down at what was left of my sandwich. The fried shrimp was delicately wrapped in a homemade remoulade.
"Mickey, no," Maggie said.
I looked up at her.
"What?"
"I know what you're thinking. The judge will never buy it. She was a defense attorney, and she knows all the tricks."
"Well, if I throw up on the defense table, she'll buy it."
"Come on, food poisoning? That's really bush league."
"Then fine. You come up with a way to delay death row Dana and knock her off her game."
"Look, almost all her questions are leading. Start objecting. And every time Drucker gives an opinion, call him on it.
Then I look like a nitpicker to the jury.
Then I'll do it. Same thing, we're a team. Better looking like a nitpicker than like a murderer.
I nodded. I knew objections would delay things, but they would not be enough. They would slow Berg down, but not stop her. I needed something more. I looked at Sisko.
Okay, listen. Your assignment, once we get back out there, is to watch the jury, I said. Keep your eyes on them. They were already looking tired this morning, and now they just ate lunch. Anybody starts nodding off, text Maggie, and we'll put it in front of the judge. That'll buy us some time.
On it, Sisko said.
Meantime, did you check their social media since yesterday? I asked.
I'll have to check with Lorna, Sisko said. She was watching all that stuff, so I was freed up for whatever you needed.
Part of his backgrounding job on the jurors was to continue to gather intel on them. Through his work in the garage, he'd been able to pick up names through car registrations and other means. He then parlayed that into monitoring their social media accounts wherever possible for any references to the trial.
Okay, call her before we start the afternoon session, I said. Tell her to check. See if anybody's bragging about being on the jury, saying anything the court should know about. If there's something there, we can bring it up. Maybe get a juror misconduct hearing going. That would knock Berg's plan back till Monday.
What if it's one of our keepers? Maggie asked. She was talking about the 7 jurors I had down as green on my sympathies chart. Possibly sacrificing one of them for a 2-hour delay was a tough trade-off.
We'll see when we get there, I said. If we even get there.
The discussion ended when Deputy Chan came to the holding room door and said it was time to move me back into the courtroom to start the afternoon session. Once court resumed, I started things off with an objection to Berg's ongoing use of leading questions in the examination of Detective Drucker. As I had anticipated, this brought a fierce response from Berg, who called the complaint unfounded. The judge saw merit in her argument.
Defense counsel knows that to object well after the fact is not a sustainable objection, Warfield said.
If it please the court, I said, my objection is to alert the court that this is happening as a matter of course. It is not unfounded, and I thought a directive from the bench could put an end to it. However, the defense is more than fine making contemporaneous objections as we proceed.
Please do so, Mr. Holler.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The dispute had taken 10 minutes off the clock and knocked Berg a bit off her game as she returned Drucker to the witness stand and continued to question him. Not wanting to give me the satisfaction of a sustainable objection to the form of her questions, she took extra care and time with them. This was what I wanted, and I hoped the slower pace might have the added bonus of fatiguing the freshly fed jury. If one dropped into slumber, I would be able to chew up more time by asking the judge for a directive to the jury. But all of those efforts proved moot when, an hour into the afternoon session, Berg handed me all I needed to run the clock out myself. She had moved Drucker's testimony into an area exploring who Sam Scales was and what he might have been up to at the time of his murder. Drucker recounted how he had learned that Scales had been using the alias Walter Lennon and had found applications for credit cards and subsequent billing statements under the name and address last used by Scales. Berg then moved to enter the documents as prosecution exhibits. I leaned toward Maggie and whispered, "Did we get this stuff?" I asked.
I don't know, Maggie said. I don't think so.
Berg walked copies to us after dropping duplicates off with the court clerk. I placed the pages on the table between Maggie and me, and we quickly studied them. A murder case generates a tremendous number of documents, and sometimes keeping track of it all is a full-time job. This case was no different. Plus, Maggie had come into the case replacing Jennifer only 2 weeks earlier.
neither of us had command of all the paperwork. That had been more Jennifer's job than mine, because I wanted to keep a minimal number of documents with me in the jail. But I was pretty sure I had never seen these papers before. "You have the discovery report there?" I asked. Maggie went into her briefcase and pulled out a file. She located a printout with a one-line description of all documents received from the district attorney's office as part of discovery. She ran her finger down the column and then checked a second page. "No, they're not here," she said. I immediately stood up.
"Objection!"
I said, with a fervor I rarely used in a courtroom. Berg stopped in mid-question to Drucker. The judge, startled, as if the steel door to the holding cell had been slammed with great force.
"What is your objection, Mr. Holler?"
she asked. "Judge, once again, the prosecution has willfully violated the rules of discovery," I said. "The efforts to keep the defense from evidence to which it rightfully should have access has just been staggering in—"
"Let me stop you right there," the judge said quickly. "Let's not get into this in front of the jury."
Warfield then told the jurors that court was adjourning for a short afternoon break. She asked them to be back in the assembly room in 10 minutes. We waited as the jurors slowly made their way out of the box and to the courtroom's exit. My anger grew with each second of silence. Warfield waited for the door to close behind the last juror before finally addressing the situation.
"Okay, Mr. Holler," she said. "Now speak."
I moved to the lectern. I had hoped to manufacture a delay tactic that would push the most damaging part of Drucker's testimony into Monday, when I would be able to address and mitigate it in a timely manner. I didn't care whether the delay was legit, but I had just been handed a discovery violation that was as righteous as anything I could have imagined. I teed it up and swung hard. "Judge, this is just incredible," I began. "After all the issues we've already had in discovery, they just go and do it again. I've never seen these documents. They are not on any supplemental discovery lists. They are a complete surprise. And now they're exhibits? They want the jury to see them, but they've never let me see them. And I'm the one being tried for murder here. I mean, come on, Judge. How can this keep happening again and again, and with no sanctions, no deterrent?"
"Ms. Berg, Mr. Holler says he hasn't received this in discovery. What is your response?"
Warfield said. I had been aware the entire time I was speaking that Berg was leafing through a thick white binder that had the word